This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 27 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me today is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing the industrial design philosophy of Star Trek. Well, Mike, how are you today?
I'm doing quite well, Zachary. It's been a bit of an exhausting week so far, but glad to be doing this. As we've always said, this is the fun thing we get to do every week.
Well, likewise, it's actually been a kind of a stressful couple weeks for me. And so because of that, I didn't really have as much of a chance to prepare for today's episode as I would have liked. So, just a fair warning to the listeners out there, we're kind of winging this episode. We have a topic we think will be interesting to talk about. We suspect there are a lot of great connections we can make, but we don't have a plan for today. We're winging it.
Yeah, I think Zachary, that in a perfect world, we would have probably had Mike and Denise Okuda join us on this episode, but they were unavailable, so...
Yeah, who better to talk about Star Trek and design with than Mike and Denise Okuda?
Yeah, indeed.
Maybe we can have them back. Maybe this episode will be so great that they'll just be dying to come on Metatrex.
We would love to have them, that's for sure. And this is a great topic, and it's something that I see conversations occasionally in the Babel Conference. I've heard references in other Trek FM podcasts. But to get to discuss industrial design philosophy and look at it, from a philosophical standpoint, I think this is going to be a really fascinating conversation.
Yeah, I didn't really know what else to call this. Lately I've been really interested in the development of technology in general, having worked in education technology for a long time now, and having kind of grown up in this largely technological age, starting with the personal computer when I was a little kid back in the early 80s, and into today, now I've got this great iPhone, this amazing sort of almost magic device in my pocket. And I've been really thinking about sort of the cultural and philosophical assumptions and the environment that leads to this kind of technological society. And of course, Star Trek, comes out of this 1960s progressivism in the original series. Think about all the technology development going on in the 1960s. You get the foundations for what became the personal computer, and the development of the transistor, and you get mm-hmm. the space race going on. All this stuff is going on, and it's a very progressive time. The future and modernism and all the design aspects that go along with that were really central to, they were kind of happening right in the background when the original series was developed. And, I think it's easy to kind of take that that technological strain that you see in Star Trek and separate it from those cultural and philosophical factors that led to its being so appealing in the 1960s. And it's something that I'm interested in as a result of thread in my own life, and something I've been reading quite a bit about lately. I thought it'd be fun to try to talk about a little bit and see what threads we can weave into this discussion of Star Trek and philosophy here on Metatrex.
Yeah, I'm glad, Zachary, that you mentioned the original series right off the bat, because I don't think, at least today, I don't think that the original series gets the credit that it's due in terms of its design aesthetics when it comes to technology. We look at it, obviously, from a 21st century perspective, looking back on, design aesthetics of the 1960s, it's very boxy. And in terms of the technology itself, it's buttons, it's switches. It's very low graphic, obviously, they're creating a television show in the late 1960s. But I've got to say, and this will probably spark a lot of debate among our friends in the Babel Conference, all the delegates there. But I think of all of the series that you know, we were given, live action series of Star Trek, the original series was so far ahead of its time. Because you're right, we were right there on the precipice of all of this technological development, and the original series just went so far beyond that current technological development, and they were really really light years ahead. And not to say that you know, the Next Generation didn't give us some really incredible technology, and certainly not to say that Voyager or Deep Space Nine. But in terms of the, you know, the extrapolation of where technology is going to go, I just think the original series was so far ahead of its time. And again, when you're comparing the original series to Next Generation or to certainly Enterprise, there's a lot of comparisons with Enterprise because of how modern the technology seems on that series as opposed to the original series that, you know, was 800 years in time backward, or rather forward. I just don't think it gets the credit that it's due.
Well, I think everyone has some sense that the original series was really prophetic in terms of the technology that ended up stemming from it. You know, we hold in our hands these devices, smartphones that are essentially, you know, quite a bit smarter than what a tricorder could do back in the sure. Back in the original series. But that said, though, I think it's also very easy to forget the culture around technology at the time. At the time Star Trek came out, we were smack in the middle of the Cold War, mm-hmm. and computers at the time were these big monstrosities of a device, right? They were room-sized devices that were not friendly. They were part of the Vietnam War machine. These were not something to be revered or desired, or definitely weren't friendly, user-friendly devices. And along comes the original series with a talking computer, you know, something you could talk to, and it would talk back, even in its sort of corny Majel Barrett's computer voice. Mm-hmm. But it was supposed to be something friendly and accessible. It was there alongside you to help you, and wasn't something that was clunky, something you had to learn to use. It was just there in the background, and it helped create a better world, give you the kinds of information you want, let you go out on your missions and get done what needs to be done. And I just think it's really easy to forget that technology, progress in technology like that, wasn't always something to be revered. Computers were something to be feared at one point.
Right.
And along comes Star Trek with a very, very different vision of how technology could help our species be a better species.
Absolutely. And I think that's really what stands out to me, is that all of the technology throughout every iteration of Star Trek, whether it's the original series or whether it's Enterprise, it strikes me, Zachary, that all of the technology that's presented to us, the Star Trek fans, they're all technologies that are very, very, very industrial. They're designed to be user-friendly, and they're designed to provide convenience. It's fascinating to me that we're never presented with a piece of mundane technology. It's all very necessary. It's all very useful. It's all very user-friendly. And all of it designed to maximize productivity and convenience and comfort and so on. So that's really the first thing that jumps out at me when I think about the technology that we're presented with in Star Trek.
I'm glad you mentioned that aspect, Mike, because as I was preparing for the show, the little preparation I did, I was thinking about Star Trek The Next Generation and the sort of very explicit user-friendliness of what you see in the Enterprise-D. Mm-hmm. You know, these sleek, elegant touch control panels, what we now know as Okudagrams, that are intended to automatically reconfigure themselves for each user. These are kinds of things you read about in like the Star Trek The Next Generation technical manual. You never really see it on screen so much. But everything from, you know, all the tools are, whether they're the pads or the tricorders, they're all sort of these ergonomic shaped devices. It was designed to lead to comfort, in the sense that comfort really helps you live a better, more productive life. And I was thinking, you know, we live in an interesting time when technology is really to the point when it could have this transformative power to change what it means to be a working, functioning, contributing member of society. Even back in the early 60s, into the 70s, and definitely into the 80s, there came to be this concept of a knowledge worker, someone who doesn't slave away and toil away in a factory or building something, that it's possible to be sort of paid and be a contributing member of society for the knowledge and the mental skills and the ability to contribute in this sort of technological mental sense, as opposed to a hands-on physical kind of sense. And you see that in the Enterprise D. You know, I think, you know, the idea there, I think, is that literally the Enterprise could run itself, right? And this is why they show so many scenes of the crew of the Enterprise, you know, playing classical music in 10 forward, I think. There's time for leisure on the Enterprise D because we've solved the problems of work. The ship can kind of run itself. And so you don't have to slave away in order to be a contributing member of Starfleet or contributing member of the crew of the Enterprise. And it's interesting because now, as we live in this technological age, we really are to the point where we could, in theory, feed the masses. We could, in theory, automate a great many tasks, and yet we all still go to work every day. And so that transformative power hasn't really led to a radical change in work. Yes, there are these new kinds of jobs. I've had one of those jobs for a long time, but I still go to work and I still stress about work and whatnot. It hasn't had that transformative power, I think, for most of our lives, to the degree we would like to see, and the degree it seems to have changed the culture of work that we see in Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Right, absolutely. You know, it's funny how the attitudes about technology changed between the original series and Star Trek: The Next Generation. You know, in the original series, you know, they're putting a computer on the bridge of the Enterprise, and interestingly enough, this computer is going to automate everything. And literally, as you said, the ship would be able to fly itself. And how that supercomputer became, in many ways, the villain of the episode. And we find ourselves in the future, and we're on board the Enterprise D, and we literally have a ship here that can, in fact, nearly fly itself. In fact, there are a couple of episodes, you know, where they're able to operate that ship with, you know, with just a couple of people on board.
Well, we learned from Commander Riker that the ship can clean itself, right?
It can clean itself.
I suspect that Riker's quarters need a great deal of automatic cleaning from the computer. What do you think?
And what are you staring at? You never seen a woman before.
I thought I had.
I think that the biofilters definitely worked overtime in his quarters.
That's possible.
But, you know, you mentioned the user friendliness of what we now know as the Okudagrams. I think, again, how imaginative of Star Trek, you know, literally years before. You know, I've got sitting here on my desk right now, you know, my iPad that is, you know, as our listeners know, all touchscreen technology, that really, Zachary, this technology is relatively new. And I know that's difficult for some people to, but, you know, like me, I can't remember a time when I didn't have a touchscreen smartphone, but, I'm thinking back to when my daughter was born. Come to think of it, you know, my cell phone was one of those candy bar phones that had like buttons on it. And my daughter now, 14 years removed, can't even imagine a telephone with buttons on it. You know, so we go from, you know, the jelly bean buttons of the TOS era, and here we are in the 1980s, and we have these amazing touch screens, really 20 years before anything like that became well known. And what I find fascinating about those touch screens and the way that they're designed, you talked about efficiency, but they're actually quite complicated. And I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with the Okudagrams. All of those buttons are numeric in nature. It's interesting because if somebody walks up to the tactical station and is playing around, Tasha Yar would break their hand. Don't. That's a torpedo launcher. And you can't touch that. Well, how the heck did she know it was a torpedo launcher? Because it has a numeric code on it. So, you know, I work in healthcare, and diagnosis, for instance, that are used, a year ago were ICD-9 codes. Now they're ICD-10 codes, so everything gets a numeric value. We almost don't even call diagnoses anymore in the healthcare field by their name. They're known as their ICD-10 code. They're given that numeric value. So I see where there is this correlation, if you will, between the technology of Star Trek and the technology that we're using in the everyday world now.
And it's funny to make that connection to the technology we use today, because one of the things I've been reading about, this is just kind of something I read about in my spare time, but I've recently been reading about the connection between what I would call the technology movement, you know, the personal computer revolution in the mid to late 1970s, and how that is related to the internet movement in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And before that, how that led the people who were involved in both of those movements, whether I'm thinking of people like Steve Jobs with Apple or Stuart Brand with The Well, one of the well-known first internet bulletin board systems, like an online community, right? You know, these are things we kind of take for granted. We don't even use those terms necessarily to talk about them anymore. We don't really talk about online communities like they did in the 1990s, like America Online and Prodigy and whatnot, these bulletin board-esque type online you know, there weren't quite services yet.
Right.
They were more like online communities. And the people who were involved in those very often were tied in some way to the counterculture movement in the 1960s. And of course, Star Trek comes out of that in a very different kind of way. I'm thinking of things like the Whole Earth catalog. It's kind of a well-known fact that Steve Jobs read the Whole Earth catalog. And he kind of latched onto this idea that if you really want to change the world, one way you do that is to invent new tools for other people to use, because tools have this amplification effect. You can use tools to invent even better tools, and then you can use those tools to invent even better tools. And before you know it, you can really transform the entire world through developing new tools that amplify these innate attributes of the human mind. And it's funny because Steve Jobs used to talk about these things, and I think most people used to roll their eyes at him, except he really did succeed in changing the world in a lot of ways. You know, he would have this story that the mind, in fact, I forget the exact study. I wish I was better at researching things and getting actual facts. So sorry to listeners out there who wish I had actual dates and names and facts and like, it's not my bandwagon. I'm a philosopher. But I remember an interview with Steve Jobs in which he was talking about this research that was done about human mobility, that you can walk and you can run, and they would measure certain attributes, how many calories you're burning, how efficient you are at using energy and whatnot. And so in this study, one thing they tested, in addition to all these sort of basic human mobility attributes or skills, is a person on a bicycle. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the person on a bicycle blows everyone else out of the water, right? This bicycle amplifies this innate human ability of movement and lets you be radically more efficient at this thing we already do. And so he came up with this story. He would describe the personal computer, the Apple I and the Apple II, as a bicycle for the mind. That a computer would take these innate features of human consciousness or human critical thinking abilities and let us amplify that to a greater degree than has ever been, that is able to happen in sort of a native human mind with no assistance, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we can calculate faster, we could be more productive, whatever that means, whatever human productivity and mental critical thinking power means, his basic insight was that we can amplify those skills and let us be radically more productive with our minds than we could be left to our own devices. And it turns out, you know, in fact, he even wanted to call the original Apple a bicycle.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm sure not the original Apple, the Macintosh. His original name for the Macintosh was a bicycle.
Okay.
And someone had to talk him out of that and thought that was a terrible name. But yeah, you can imagine the Apple bicycle. But yeah, I think that's a really interesting insight. So, you know, if you want to really change the world and empower people, you develop better tools for them to use. And in Star Trek, you see no shortage of these kinds of tools that have this transformative power. You see tricorders that give you access to any kind of information you want about your environment. You don't have to research it and study it. It's just there at your fingertips. You've got medical devices that solve medical problems. You've got warp drive, of course, that empowers us. And it's like a bicycle writ large, right?
Yes.
Picture the Enterprise as a bicycle, the USS bicycle. You've got warp drive that lets you, you know, radically increase the range of human influence in the galaxy and exploration. Think of the spheres of interactions and knowledge that it opens up for mankind that, you know, we just couldn't have left to our own little... meager planet Earth. So, you know, I think the connection is really interesting that you get this kind of this idea that if you want to change the world, you develop tools. But one of these ideas comes from this Whole Earth catalog that I mentioned. And the Whole Earth catalog, I was not familiar with this before I started reading about it because I am a little too young. I was born in 1978, so I missed this entire wave. You're a little older than I am. I don't know if you remember much of this at all, Mike, either.
I do.
But the Whole Earth catalog was like this, you know, remember back before the internet, right? There were catalogs, right. And you had to order stuff. Right?
Yes.
Think about that. The idea was there were these sort of communes and communal living societies that were out there that people were trying to form these experimental ways of living that were different from, you know, your average suburban life coming out of the 1950s, out of World War II. Mm-hmm. So you get alternative ways of living. And these people need tools to be self-sustainable and to get things done and to feed themselves and whatnot, whether they're gardening tools or any other kind of tool, right? So the Whole Earth catalog was a way of delivering tools to these alternative communities. Very fascinating. And Steve Jobs used to read this. And in one of those articles in there, I don't have the author's name handy, but I, if anyone's industrious, go look it up. And I apologize for not citing sources here. But in one of those articles, the claim is made that if you want to change the world, you invent better tools for people to use. And Steve Jobs read that, and that influenced his thinking and led to this really kind of radical technological development, because the people who were involved in technology development didn't just want to invent tools that made money. They literally wanted to change the world and make the world a better place. And that was part of their ethos in developing something new in the first place. Anyone can make a buck 1,000 easier ways than trying to invent something. It's really hard to invent something that's never been invented before. And this transformative power that's coming out of this culture of the 1960s really has changed the world around us. And I think it culminates in the kind of environment you see in Star Trek The Next Generation into the 1980s.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think our history has been transformed by human ingenuity. From the invention of the wheel, Zachary, I think we have constantly been in a state of transformation through our ability to invent better tools. I think you hit the nail definitely on the head there. And the thing that I find fascinating about Star Trek of the 1960s is the fact that, you know, they didn't invent tools, they invented concepts. And I think that the concepts that Gene Roddenberry and Dorothy Fontana and all of these incredible minds who wrote these scripts and put these shows together, and all the way to the guys that built the props. I mean, you think about the concepts, they're pulling these things certainly out of what they see around them, but they're extrapolating and they are envisioning and dreaming. And those things that we called science fiction in the 1960s, many of them are science fact. And we're constantly making strides towards that progressive, hopeful future that we dreamed about in the 1960s. And, you know, it gets me thinking about about progress and how the tools that we invent really push us forward. You know, you made the joke about, you know, the Enterprise being a bicycle. I suddenly think of Scotty in the engine room on a stationary bicycle. I'm giving
peddling
it all
away.
I got, Captain. Yeah, just pedaling away. Yeah.
I cannot get any more RPMs.
but again, you know, we dreamed and we envisioned and we extrapolated, and what we once called science fiction is now science fact. And I think that I think that bodes very well for all of us geeks out there. And there's a lesson to be learned about the power of a dream.
Well, I think people have this really interesting vision of technologists, especially back in the 70s and 80s. You know, if you were into technology back then, you had to be something of a nerd or a geek or whatnot, right? You just had to be.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, though, a lot of these people that really had this transformative power, people like Stuart Brand with the well, people like Steve Jobs, these were people that had this kind of idealist counterculture bent to them. They were the hippies. They weren't necessarily the nerds working for HP, right? and it's funny because, you know, there's a mindset, you know, in the 60s, people were 60s and into the early 70s, people were thinking about alternative living, communes and whatnot. In the 90s, those very same people wanted to take those ideals and build them into the internet. Let's have online communities. And that's not a stretch from communal living in the 60s and 70s. And then if you take that kind of to the nth degree, what would an ideal community be? Let's take a group of people, put them on a starship, put them out in space, and ask the question, what would be the ideal way of humans to interact with each other when they are a genuine community together off in space, absent all of these radically human concerns that you get back on planet Earth in the contemporary age? Strip all those away. Solve the problems of scarcity for economics.
Mm-hmm.
Solve the problems of labor on the Enterprise D, right? Solve all those problems, put a group of people in space, and then ask the question, what would those people be like? You know, what features of human nature would rise to the occasion in the absence of all of these constraining factors that have defined the human experience for thousands of years?
You know, it's interesting, Zachary, because, you know, we've talked a little bit about the philosophy of the Federation in Metatrex 25, entitled Feed Me, Gok. And we were talking about the prevalence of hedonism in the Federation. And it's interesting because the technology that we see in Star Trek really kind of reinforce that philosophy, that idea that, you know, to maximize pleasure and, you know, to get the best results. And you're right, even though we do see for instance, Starfleet personnel in the various series talking about pulling a double shift or, you know, occasionally being irritated by their coworkers, you know, the things that are almost daily for the rest of us, you know, occasionally we see
staying up late for crew evaluations.
Yes, yes, yes. All of these things that,
working so hard on the Enterprise D. Sweat pouring off their brows.
Yes, yes, absolutely. and yet, you know, they can, you know, I'm sitting here with my Coudagram cup, this gift by a dear friend of mine, Tea Earl Grey Hot. And it occurs to me that, you know, I have this convenience called a Keurig coffee maker, and I put my little tea bag in there. And I push a button and I suddenly have hot tea in my Coudagram Tea Earl Grey hot cup. But that is so much easier than what we were doing a generation ago, boiling water. And so, you know, it forces me to ask the question, you know, how far are we from walking up to a computer panel and saying Tea Earl Grey hot? And instead of me having to fill a reservoir and push a button, I just simply speak and I've got the perfect cup of Earl Grey.
But I think, you know, my concern about this line of reasoning, I think, is just that, you know, you would like to think that, you know, these developments in technology would have this transformative power to make life more convenient, to make life less stressful. And frankly, almost everyone I know is as stressed out as humans have ever been. I think there's something about human nature that leads to, cultivating a certain kind of stress level and a certain kind of environment that is counter to that progressive instinct that ideally, I think we would solve all these problems. You wouldn't have to wait for your cup of tea and you could do something amazing while you're saving all these minutes and hours. You wouldn't have to work as hard. You wouldn't even have to go to work necessarily. You could still contribute in some way and be productive without having to be a laborer. So the fundamental question for me, I guess, is just why hasn't technology transformed the human condition away from this I would say a default level of stress that defines the human condition? It hasn't. even though I don't slave away in a field, I toil away, and I don't feel like life is a life of leisure as a result. Definitely not the life of leisure you see most people living on the Enterprise D when they're not staying up late for crew evaluations.
Well, I think you ask a great question. You know, I've thought about this, you know, quite a bit, because every time you come out with a new piece of technology or a new app, you know, the hype around these things, it's going to save us time. It's going to increase productivity. It's, you know, it's going to make our lives easier. And, you know, our homes are filled with these conveniences that are supposed to save us time and make life easier. And you're absolutely right. We are more stressed out now in society than we've ever been. I'm a manager, and you know, we talk about the, you know, technology improving productivity, and yet here we are in 2016, and productivity is at an all-time low. We are actually less productive now than we were 20 years ago, before technology started to transform the workplace. So I think that's an excellent question. You know, something else that kind of comes out of that question for me, Zachary, is all of these things that make life easier and convenient. I think mankind as a species has always thrived through adversity. You know, the old saying is nothing grows on a beach. You know, so if life is a beach, nothing grows really on a beach. You plant a flower in sand, and you know, it's just a matter of time before it's going to wither and die. But if you plant it in fertilized soil, and we all know what fertilizer is, don't we? it thrives.
No,
so,
Mike, what is it?
But I think out of that question that you ask, I think comes comes kind of a follow-up question. All of these things that are supposed to make us more productive, isn't there a danger, Zachary, of them making us less productive? I think the characters of the next generation have evolved somehow, because I think with all of that extra time, we would become a very lazy society. And that's, you know, that's just my point of view, but I know that there are lots of folks who share that.
Well, I think that's a really important question, because I think Star Trek is somewhat committed to the idea that in solving technological problems by removing these burdens that define the human condition, that will lead to a society that is more idealistic, that has problems that are solved, that will allow people to be the most fruitful versions of themselves in a way that has never been possible in the history of humankind before. I think that's the technological bent of Star Trek, that Star Trek has this kind of technological progressive bent, that in solving these technological and social problems using technology, that will that allow the human race to flourish in a way that it just never has before. You know, I guess it's a really important question. Is that a realistic expectation of humankind, or do we have certain parts of our human nature that will prevent that from being that idealistic story of human progress and flourishing from actually happening anytime in the future, no matter how many technological problems we solve? Are these just innate things about human nature, or are those elements of human nature themselves problem? I guess what I'm asking is, are those problems with human nature, are they innate factors, or are they problems that can be solved through technology as well? Is that an effect of these extraneous factors that can be removed, or is that something so deeply ingrained in human nature that the vision of the future and the vision of humanity that we see in Star Trek, that technological road to getting there is that realistic or not?
Yeah, Zachary, I can really only speak for myself. You know, for me personally, I don't think that technology necessarily is going to solve the human problem. We kind of talked about this quite a while back, episode 15 of Metatrex, which is entitled The Philanthropist Negus. We talked about the paradox of the philosopher king, and in that particular episode, we had a fairly lengthy discussion about the original series episode Plato's Stepchildren. And, you know, we talked about how absolute power can corrupt absolutely. And, you know, here's a society that as they improved themselves, they became somewhat more corrupt. And we've seen that to some degree in our society now. So I think probably the first thing that would have to happen with humanity in order to achieve the type of enlightenment that we see certainly in Star Trek The Next Generation, I think that there's got to be a philosophical evolution, quite honestly, in humanity, in which we would allow technology to make life easier for us, and we would thrive as a result. However, I think, at least in terms of our current state of evolution, we would probably be more like the characters in Plato's Stepchildren. I'm afraid that we would, you know, we would become lazy. We would become restless, and you know, go honestly backwards as a society, as a culture.
It's interesting to go back and think about that episode, Plato's Stepchildren, now in light of the discussion we're having today, because it strikes me, and I kind of realized this already in Star Trek, that when the humans in Star Trek encounter an alien race or an alien world that has some sort of problem, most of the time you can put the mirror up and that alien race is a mirror right back at humanity. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of interesting juxtaposition of the humans, who are somewhat idealistic and have had all of these problems in society be solved, go to this alien world, and really they're shining the mirror right back at contemporary humans. Look at how ridiculous this is. And so, Mike, I think you're asking a really important question. So the Platonians in that episode, Plato's Stepchildren, are they a good example of something that in Star Trek, I mean, what is the Star Trek picture? Is that episode of Star Trek saying that mankind will eventually overcome those kinds of concerns? You know, this power hungry corruption, the kind of dystopian society you see there in Plato's Stepchildren. You know, is that something that humans have certainly in Star Trek world, you know, the humans have overcome that, right? Okay, yeah, absolutely. But what is the ultimate takeaway from that episode? Is the episode, let's have hope and optimism, is the takeaway, let's have hope and optimism for the future, knowing that we will transcend beyond this kind of petty, you know, small-minded power hungriness that you see in the world? Or is this something that, you know, if we look at that mirror too long, we'll realize we're never going to get off that train, that no matter how many problems we solve, if the Platonians, you know, their Star Trek's picture of what can happen when you solve all the problems, right? When you solve all the problems, look what happens. The Platonians create this real evil society, you know. So which vision of the future is correct? When you solve, you know, the problems of society, I think using technology, I don't think you can separate this progressiveness you see in Star Trek from the technology development that you see along with it. I think Star Trek is kind of, they're intimately tied together in some way, much as it was, like, I'm trying to make the case that that's been the case from the 60s and into the 90s into today. You know, in solving those problems, do you get the same old human nature that keeps rearing up, culminating in something like you see in Plato's Stepchildren? Or is the right takeaway that, no, humans really can't? And I know what Gene Roddenberry thought. He really thought, you know, humans can step away from these lower basic features of human nature, and we can transcend those. But, you know, arguably, you know, if you want to take a darker reading of that episode, you could say, look, now the Platonians are the picture of humankind when we've solved all the problems. Nothing's going to change. We'll just put it in outer space. And yeah, we won't have to work as hard. We won't have to cook our food. We'll go to a replicator. We can live a little longer because we've solved some of these problems of human biology and aging. We, you know, we don't have to toil away in a field. We can just ask the computer for what we want. But when it comes right down to it, when you solve all the problems, that same old human nature will keep creeping up.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's an interesting point of view. I'm not presenting this as my personal take on it, but I find it fascinating that it's almost like a campaign slogan. We Plato's Stepchildren, you presented, you know, juxtapose here these two possibilities. You know, do we become lazy and corrupt, or do we evolve past that? And So you've got that kind of comparison. You mentioned, let's have hope, let's have a positive future. It almost seems like a campaign slogan. and then you vote. And,
well, it is an election year.
But yeah, it is an election year, yes. And by the way, many a politician have campaigned on the slogan of hope and change and progress and going all the way, all the way back through throughout our history. So those are popular concepts, and I think history shows that mankind aspires to that, and I see that certainly in the technology of Star Trek. I think we aspire to greatness. We aspire to invent and envision things that will make us more productive and these conveniences. But I think that it's quite possible that once we pull the lever, as they say, or at least I'm giving away my age. I remember pulling the lever, Zachary. Now you just touch the screen. But I think once you pull the lever, sometimes you get exactly the opposite. So I go back to the Ultimate Computer from the original series. You know, here was the M5 was created. It was designed to make Star Trek starships operate more efficiently, to allow even a subskeleton crew to operate the most advanced starship in Starfleet. However, the end result was quite scary. And thankfully, Captain Kirk was on board and was able to talk that computer into destroying itself. So I don't know. Hopefully there'll be somebody there to save us from ourselves. But
well, I think it's a little strange that on the Enterprise D in particular, you don't see more funny cat videos on all the monitors, I'm serious. We have in our device, in our pockets, these great, amazing devices. They're more powerful than the tricorders, right? You can get access to anything you want. There's never been a time in the whole history of the planet when it's been easier to learn something or make something new or invent something or, follow your dreams because you can invent it because all the tools are literally in your pocket. That's never been true in the whole history of mankind. And the vast majority of people share funny cat videos. So why aren't there more funny cat videos on the Okudagrams?
Well, we were talking in the turbo lift earlier, about, religion and prophecy. And it seems to me that the prophetically speaking, the prophecy is that there will come a time when we'll be ever learning, but unable to come to the knowledge of the truth. And I think to some degree, we're almost living in those kinds of times, because you're right. We do have literally in my fingertips, I'm holding my smartphone in my hand, and this thing is connected to a vast library of knowledge. I can look up just about anything. I can, find out where the closest grocery store is to me. I can look up one of these big philosophical terms that we throw around from time to time and get a definition. And
We can make a podcast from our iPhones.
We can do it from our iPhone.
We should do that one time just to say we did it.
I can look it up, Zachary, and I can tell you what Immanuel Kant. Said about ethics.
Okay. I think this is really, really important. And this is something that I find disappointing about the contemporary world. A lot of people I know who use technology, I find it interesting to think about what it would mean in Star Trek terms. I think it's actually a real shame that more people aren't using the tools that they have. If you want to change your life, you can learn something new or you can make something new and you have the power to do it. And it's probably right there in your pocket, right?
Absolutely.
And most people aren't doing that. They're complaining about work. They're complaining about their station in life. They're being very fatalist about what life has dealt them when they have been given tools that other people took the time to think about and invent, hoping to change the world. And people aren't necessarily making use of it. So what does that mean? What do the characters in Star Trek do with this immense technological progress they've been given inside Star Trek? And I almost feel like I need to apologize. We started out wanting to talk about industrial design and the design aspects of Star Trek. We ended up talking more about technology. And I do want to circle back and talk a little bit about the design aspects of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. But what are these characters in Star Trek doing to be the best versions of themselves, given that all these problems of humankind have been solved, all of the needs and the constraints of human life have been solved. How are they being creative in ways they couldn't be before? Can you think of any examples off the top of your head, Mike, of how this empowerment aspect of technology affects any of the particular characters you see in Star Trek?
Well, I know how it's not affecting them. I mean, we never saw a scene where Data is watching an internet cat video.
Well, and it's actually really funny because Data is probably better at this than almost any of the humans you see on the Enterprise D. Data paints and Data learns the violin and Data does all these sort of liberal artsy kind of things that you might see some of the characters doing, right? You know, there are other musicians in Star Trek. Dr. Crusher likes drama. She likes to put on plays and whatnot.
She's Captain a great Picard tap dancer.
Shakespeare. I wonder if Captain Picard reads Shakespeare in the bathroom of his ready room. You know? Does he take that book into the bathroom with him and spend his spare time? You know, he's got a couple of minutes of downtime and he's, you know, whip out that Shakespeare. What are they doing?
Disturbing mental picture right now of Captain Picard sitting on the can reading Shakespeare.
It's interesting because it seems like you can find these one-off things like, okay, Dr. Crusher, she likes drama, and Data, he likes to paint and he plays the violin, mm-hmm. and Geordi, he does something on the holodeck.
He's terrible with women.
He's terrible with women on the holodeck. Picard, he reads Shakespeare, and he's an archaeologist, right?
So Riker's a musician.
Riker's a musician, absolutely plays the trombone. You know, can we go down the list here on the Enterprise D? Who are we leaving out?
Worf likes Klingon opera.
What?
We didn't find that out though until really Deep Space Nine, but
he certainly improves his skills with the Bat'leth.
Oh yeah.
So he has a little bit of enough downtime to do that. Is Worf really empowered by technology? I don't know.
But you know, you make a really great point. Going back to Data and his quest to learn and to understand humanity, it occurs to me that really a couple of our greatest technological wonders in Star Trek, Data the Android and the Holographic Doctor, are almost obsessive with their desire to expand themselves beyond their original programming. And Zachary, I think in that is something that every human should aspire to. And you're absolutely right. You know, we don't see Data watching silly cat videos. I have this this scene in my head of Geordi kind of walking up behind him going, Data, what are you doing? I'm attempting to amuse myself watching an internet cat video.
Yeah, No. Data doesn't watch cat videos. He makes them and posts them on Space YouTube.
Spot.
The Spot channel on
the
Space
Spot
YouTube.
Channel. The greatest technological wonder of Star Trek, the Spot channel. I think we should have had it. You know, again, you know, what are they doing? They are bettering themselves. And I see that theme throughout Star Trek, and it certainly ties into their technology, and it ties into the overall design of their ships and their space stations, and you know, right down to the chair in Worf's quarters completely doesn't fit this. That ball chair, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
With all that just forget about that, because that's the exception to the rule. Everything else is
Worf's
designed to
peacock,
maximize
yeah.
comfort and convenience and leisure and, you know, overall make life better.
Well, I think the two go hand in hand. And I think, you know, while it saddens me a little bit to see people not making use of the tools and possibilities they've been given, you know, it's almost a challenge. I think, you know, Star Trek is a mirror for us, right? You know, here today, you know, here in 2016, what can we learn from Star Trek? Well, use the tools to make the world a better place, make your own life better, improve your situation, learn something, make something, do something, right? Whatever it is, you know, the tools probably exist in some way. So, I'm interested in this transformative power and this empowering aspect of technology. But at the same time, we do need our downtime. And you see both on the Enterprise D, right? You see the way in which technology empowers people to be creative and empowers people to you know, get out of the galaxy and be the best versions of themselves. But you also see that they do need their downtime. They do have leisure in a way that, you know, it's portrayed in a very caricature kind of way, in especially in Star Trek The Next Generation, right? You know, they're playing violin, mm-hmm. and we're acting out a play and all these, reading Shakespeare, you know, these lofty sort of liberal artsy kind of visions of what humans are good at. But it's important to have leisure. And I think, you know, what I'm not saying is go out and, you know, force yourself to get nose to the grindstone every single day. And, you know, if you're not learning something right this very minute, you're being lazy. That's definitely not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there's probably some tools to improve your own life or improve the world that you're not using to the greatest degree. And in doing so, hopefully you can get that leisure time that asks you that gives you the leisure to ask these introspective questions about your own nature and what the world should be. And this is the reason I think that the liberal arts are called liberal arts, right? On the one hand, they empower you to be free, you know, in a very, free will kind of sense. The more you know, the more you think about, the more possibilities you see. You have a broader sphere of choices for yourself. On the other hand, you can really only do things like that if you have time for leisure, right? If you're slaving away in a field for 16 hours a day, you don't have time for leisure to think about what life could be and what tools are going to get you there, right? You're too busy plowing the fields. And in Star Trek, you see an interesting juxtaposition of progress and a better vision of humankind and the leisure to think about these deeper questions. They go hand in hand.
Well, I love the design aesthetics of the first season, Next Generation. Here's the thing. We figured out how to combine leisure and work. I love the ops and helm stations on the original Enterprise D in the first season.
Yeah, they're laying down.
It's like they're laying back, because flying a starship in the 24th century, Zachary, is so simple you can do it lying down.
I was going to say, it's such tiring work, you have to lay down.
No, it's so easy. I mean, it's just so easy. You just lay back and fly the ship. You just lay back and do a sensor sweep. I love in the very first episode of Next Generation, Encounter at Farpoint, when they did the saucer separation and when they brought the ship back together. I remember, you know, the intensity of that scene. You know, I'm thinking about this in my mind.
The computer did it all. Why is it such a stressful
thing?
The computer did it all, right? I guess it was a manual.
Was a manual docking, okay? Right. And there was kind of all this tension on the bridge.
But all he did was stand there and say, steady, steady.
Yes, that's all he did. That's all he did. All that tension, you know.
And now.
And I remember O'Brien and Data looking at each other and kind of, you know, they're in those lounge chairs. You know, Data's at the helm. O'Brien's at ops. And they, you know, they kind of look at each other and they smile like, this is great, dude. It's Miller time.
And they even have time to tell jokes about Ferengi and gorilla suits.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
According to the flashback from the last episode.
Yes.
Well, okay, you mentioned the design aspects, and I do want to spend some time talking about the design of Star Trek, because this is what the original topic was before we spent an hour talking about technology. But the original thought that I had was that you can learn an awful lot about a people or about a culture based on the artifacts and the things that they make, the things they produce. If you look back through human history, you can find countless examples, and I listed a few, and these are just, you know, the obvious examples because that's all I've got. I'm not a historian or an archaeologist and whatnot, but I'm thinking of things like, you know, Greek and Roman architecture. Think of, you know, the Roman Colosseum and, you know, various statues or temples you see from ancient Greece. Think even in our own time, think about the monuments we produce, you know, think of the style of buildings and the architecture, you know, whether it's the Lincoln Memorial or the White House or some other type of human manufactured thing, like maybe like Mount Rushmore, a statue that's carved into a mountain, right? These things we leave behind tell a story about who we are and our values and what is important to us. And that's on a big scale. I'm thinking of like architecture there, right? But think on a smaller scale. I'm thinking of things like Greek pottery. You can learn a lot about, you know, the Greek people based on, you know, what they put on their pottery, mm-hmm. right? So if you look around the world, everything is designed. I mean, I'm sitting here in a room where literally everything I'm looking at, except the little things out my window, are designed by someone. Mm-hmm. Every design on a coffee cup, every curve of my desk, every feel of the doorknob, every color on the wall, everything has been designed. Mm-hmm. And I think we forget that this environment we live in is one that is largely a designed environment. Unless I literally walk out the door, and half the time you're seeing a landscaped environment anyway, right? Even out my front window, I don't see anything of the natural world. I see a lawn and I see some rose bushes. I see a palm tree that doesn't belong in this part of California. and these are things that tell a story about who we are and what our values are and what we think life should be about. And there's kind of two categories of design. There's the accidental category and the purposeful category. There's people that just slap stuff together and they don't give the design aspect much thought, even though they are making a bunch of implicit assumptions about bringing a lot of implicit assumptions into their designs that people may not be conscious of. But then there's the really purposeful designs, the people that are craftsmen and take the time to design an object that is maximally useful or maximally attractive or maximally beneficial in some way. And, we've been using the iPhone as an example, and I'm intrigued of the story that that Apple and mainly Johnny Ive and the other design members of the design team at Apple, the story they tell themselves about the type of device they're trying to create. You know, they want to create a beautiful device that is maximally useful and so elegant that the design kind of fades into the background. You don't even realize it was a designed object. So it got me thinking, what is the design philosophy of Star Trek? Say there's a future archaeologist, someone from the 29th century comes back in time and they're doing some sort of archaeology on the past. What's the name of the time traveler in that episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, the guy who's supposed to be from the future, Professor Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, yes.
Rasmussen, right. Yeah, he wasn't really from the future, but suppose he was. He comes back in time and, walking around the various starships you see in Star Trek, whether the original series and with this 1960s aesthetic, or Next Generation with its 1980s aesthetic, or regardless of which show it is, what would a future visitor take away from a visit to the past in that sense? Maybe even if all the people were gone, just looking at the objects, this vast amount of manufactured stuff you see that defines the aesthetic that we know is kind of the Star Trek aesthetic.
Yeah, and I think you almost have to ask that question series by series, because I think each of those series has something very unique to say, Zachary. And I almost feel like now that we've really gotten into the nuts and bolts of this, I really feel like one podcast isn't nearly enough, because you could really break this down and do it series by series. Because when you look at The Next Generation, for instance, which, we've spent a good deal of time talking about, we see, for instance, a very leisurely sort of ship. It's very comfortable. It's, very well appointed. It's like a cruise ship in the stars, as opposed to, say, something that's more utilitarian like the NX-01. It's one of the things that I love about Doug Drexler's design, is that he was able to create something that felt very utilitarian in its appointment, as compared to, say, the 1701D, or even for that matter, the original 1701 with its jelly bean buttons and bulky stations. Which in my head canon, I think was probably influenced by the Tellarites with their hooves. They needed buttons as opposed to, I don't think hooves, touch screens aren't friendly to species with hooves. So that's just my thoughts. But
it's interesting. You can kind of do this comparative survey. Okay, yeah, so we can compare the original series aesthetic and the values that it kind of takes for granted in the design. And then, of course, that's coming out of like mid-century modernism, right?
Absolutely.
A lot of the design choices are these clean, minimalist, boxy aesthetic, the kinds of things you see, like all the chairs that are almost Eames chairs sitting on the bridge, mm-hmm. right? These are coming out of mid-century modernism, maybe a few years at the tail end of it, all of that mid-century futurist aesthetic has already kind of happened, and Star Trek is picking up on the tail end of it. And in The Next Generation, you get this leisurely approach. Everything is so smooth and contoured. It's designed for human comfort and leisure and productivity and whatnot. But contrast all of that with some of the other things you see in Star Trek. Contrast the Federation aesthetic from The Next Generation with what you see in the Cardassian architecture and the Cardassian tools from Deep Space Nine, the Cardassian environments, right? Everything manufactured that you see in Deep Space Nine is a reflection of Cardassian values in some way, mm-hmm. right? And you can tell that whole story visually through objects that you see. Of course, they're not objects you can hold in your hand because they're on the screen. But the objects that you see on the screen, they tell a story about the values of that culture, and they contrast. And it might be hard to pin down any one of them. Like, can you list out all the Cardassian values you see in Cardassian architecture? Not really in a lot of detail, I think. But when you contrast it with Federation architecture and Federation design and Federation computer interfaces, you know, the contrast is really stark. And you can contrast that with the things you see on Borg ships, and you can contrast that with the manufactured objects you see on Romulan ships mm-hmm. or Klingon ships. Think of Klingon manufactured objects, right? Batliths and Metliths and, yes. you know, their control panel designs and, you know, their uniforms and, you know, every piece of manufactured design tells a story about the culture that it comes from. And it's fun and interesting to do this kind of sociological, anthropological comparative analysis, comparing the designs of these different races and the values that their manufactured objects seem to contain implicitly.
Well, Zachary, it occurs to me that the brilliant 20th century philosopher Forrest Gump once said, you can tell a lot about a man by the shoes that he's wearing, where he's going, where he's been. As funny as that is, there's a real truth to that. We can tell a lot about a people by not necessarily the shoes that he's wearing, but we can tell a lot. For instance, in sales, you and I both have a sales background. Both of us came up through the Radio Shack School of Sales.
And that was another lifetime ago. Yeah. You're reaching in the Wayback Machine there. Talk about time travel.
Going in the Wayback Machine. Step into the Wayback Machine, please.
That was like 3 careers ago.
But isn't it interesting that when you do learn the skills to be successful in sales, you learn to observe, and you make connections with people by what you observe. And those skills have served me well, very well, throughout really my entire adult life. We can observe and learn and connect. For instance, the episode Inner Light, there's a connection that Picard has, not with just the life that he lived, while he was, being influenced by the probe, but it was the connection that he had to the culture, to the people, and the flute that he retained from that experience, I think, told him, it reminded him about those people, and that was its purpose. You know, the simplicity of it, the beauty of the design. It was simple and yet elegant, and so I think that ties right into what we're talking about here when we talk about, you know, making connections to the people through the design elements that they leave behind for us. And so, you know, for instance, when I'm looking at the NX-01, I see industrious. I see, for instance,
I think mainly the color choice is that sort of that cold, darkish gray. It's not quite sparkly metallic. It's like a dark metallic.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, for that matter, you also have to appreciate the I hate to use this word, the enterprising nature of the people, and you see that in the design for Voyager, and I think the technobabble that is so famous with Voyager, I think fits the reason that the technobabble works for me is because I still look at Voyager as this incredibly technologically advanced ship, science vessel, that honestly, in terms of design throughout Star Trek, I think is unmatched in its
It's interesting you say that, because we haven't talked about Voyager pretty much at all until now. We've talked about the Next Generation, even mentioned Deep Space Nine and whatnot. But Voyager, is there anything unique that Voyager brings to the table in terms of design that is uniquely Voyager, that really adds something to the Star Trek story that can't be told in the other, in terms of the other other series? You know, because yes, you see Okudograms on, yes, Voyager. You can trace that back to the Next Generation. It's a derivative in some way. What does Voyager add that's really unique? And I'm a huge Voyager fan. I have a hard time answering that question. I think of things like neural gel packs, right? That's an interesting design aspect. You know, the ship is so smart, it's got neural gel packs to increase, uh-huh, increase its efficiency. That's a design choice too. It's not a visual design choice, because we only see them a little bit and they're not terribly interesting. They're just bags of goo. But it is a design choice, right?
Ugly bags of mostly water.
And that's the thing. When I think of design, I don't necessarily think of visual design. I think that's clear from our technological discussion, that design is anything that's designed or manufactured in any way, shape, or form, right? Everything about us that has been influenced by humankind is designed in some broad sense. So yeah, Voyager was designed to be the smartest ship in the fleet because of its neural gel packs. And it's not a visual design. Voyager is a little sleeker than the Enterprise D, perhaps, in some ways. Some people think it's a little clunky. I think it's on the sleeker side, but you know, the visual aspect aside, Voyager has some interesting design choices that give it a leg up over other starships.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. You talk about how sleek Voyager is, and it certainly is. But, you know, honestly, what comes to my mind first, Zachary, is something, you know, it's a visual aesthetic that pops into my mind almost first when you mention Voyager and you link it to design. And that, for me, someone who has a casual interest in architecture and furniture design, and is the very overstated conference table.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that. I was just thinking of the conference table. I kid you, I was literally going to mention the conference table next.
Yeah, that doggone overstated conference table. And it really says something about the series as a whole. That, and I don't mean this as an insult, please, Voyager fans, do not think that I mean this as an insult, but as a series, Voyager oftentimes was overstated. And I think that conference table, for me, really communicates that kind of...
It's like Voyager's one big floating conference table. Is that what you're...
put a couple nacelles on it, and the doggone thing is its own ship.
See, that description, a conference table in space, that sounds like the Enterprise D to me, with Captain Picard's management style. I was actually thinking of the color of the table. I was thinking, because if I remember, it's got this sort of strip of green, these green accents, mm-hmm, to it that you don't really see. It's more colorful than the other tables that you see in Star Trek, and I think that's interesting. So I thought they tried to add a touch of beauty to it, despite its overstatedness.
Yeah, it's colorful, but the surface, for instance, is not a smooth surface. It's a very contoured surface. Much of the conference table is almost unusable in terms of, you know, it's certainly not utilitarian. There's nothing utilitarian about it. It's
well, it holds Captain Janeway's coffee, so
and everybody sits around it, and that is
does
it.
Its job. It's the most important job of
that's
all.
It
where do I put my coffee put my... first? Now we can have a meeting.
But yes, so for Voyager, it's the overstated conference table.
I was also thinking of Captain Janeway's very, very large ready room.
Yeah, absolutely. Got the couch, you know.
Okay, let's take this down to a smaller scale, though. What can we learn about Star Trek design philosophy from the shape and the size and the materials of Captain Janeway's coffee cup? Even a coffee cup has to be designed. Someone had to design that coffee cup.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And why did she choose that cup? What is it? You know, can we learn something about Captain Janeway from her choice of coffee cup?
Well, start us out. Let's talk about this for a moment.
Well, I see. I actually, this is a stupid tangent, but you know, I actually collect old coffee mugs. I think they're interesting. I'll take every chance I get to collect an old coffee mug. I like restaurant coffee mugs with interesting logos on them. I love old stuff from the 1960s and 70s. You name it. If I see an interesting coffee mug, I want it. So if anyone wants to send me a coffee mug, I'm accepting coffee mugs. But even on my desk here, I've got a couple of coffee mugs. I've got this coffee mug here. You guys can't see this at home, but I've got this coffee mug out of the 1970s. It has these cute little birds that look like chickadees. It had this great sort of green 1970s grass color scheme, this sort of dark mustard yellow and these interesting things that look like, I don't know, tulies or foxtails or some sort of plant. And I just think it's an interesting design, but it's clearly 1970s. It just, you look at it and you go 1970s. I look at Captain Janeway's coffee cup and I think, okay, 24th century, I've got it. And all the little manufactured objects, you know, the things you see in 10 Ford, you know, picturing that episode, Time's Arrow, where Data goes back in time. And there's a scene there when Captain Picard is talking with Guinan about the fact that he needs to go on the mission and go back in time too, so they can meet. But Guinan is mixing this interesting concoction of beverages, you know, pouring the thing, measuring it just so, talking about how the ingredient's going to evaporate. I forget the exact
dialogue. Yeah, Guinan's little object lesson there.
It all looks very scientific and futuristic, you know. That, you know, every little design choice you see on the screen says something about the future. And you know, what can we learn something interesting about any of the characters from any of their preference for day-to-day mundane objects that are, you know, futuristic in some way because they're in Star Trek.
Well, you know, we started to touch on
green bottles. You know, Scotty likes green
bottles.
So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Especially if they're full of whiskey.
Yeah.
Or
Aldebaran
whiskey. That's exactly right. Which I think became his new favorite later in life. Somebody needs to put that on Memory Alpha, by the way, that later in life. He took a shine to Aldebaran whiskey, and yeah, I think we should add that to his profile.
I feel like all I'm doing is asking questions that I genuinely don't have the answers. I think there's something interesting going on with the design choices. They're definitely futuristic. They're definitely clean, simple, minimalist designs that are derivative of the mid-century modern, maybe the Bauhaus movement, the sort of ultra minimalist industrial design. And I'm thinking of things like Dieter Rams, you know, the design of the electronic that he did for Braun, things like, you know, radios and turntables. But, you know, if you don't know who this guy is, go look him up. His name is Dieter Rams, D-I-E-T-E-R space Rams, R-A-M-S. Mm-hmm. Look him up and look at his designs. They're extremely minimalist, stripping out anything but the bare necessities of the designs. And yet they're beautiful and they're functional. And though that kind of design philosophy is kind of what I see, definitely see it in Star Trek The Next Generation. You can see seeds of it with the minimalist designs in the original series. But what's interesting to me is this minimalist design doesn't have to be ugly. I think some people really hate it, though. Some people want beauty to be like more Baroque, you know, flourishes and mm-hmm. colors. And you know, Star Trek, I think, has this kind of more minimalist bent towards its beauty. And that appeals to me. So the things I see in Star Trek, these manufactured objects, whether they're a Saurian brandy bottle or whether they're one of Guinan's goblets that she's mixing her beverages in, whether it's Captain Janeway's coffee cup, whether it's the shape of the chairs on the original series Enterprise, the 1701, they look kind of like Eames chairs. All of those to me have this kind of simple aesthetic beauty to them. They're not just minimalist; they're beautiful and fluid in some way. They're not totally square and boxy. You see some interesting curves and shapes that they're supposed to be aesthetically interesting and not purely functional.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Well, Zachary, we have rolled well past an hour. Just in terms of my final thoughts, my hope is that going forward with the new Star Trek series, I hope they take these cues. You mentioned the constant minimalist thread, and I think that's very true, with the exception of Captain Janeway's conference table.
That is one ample conference table.
That is an ample conference table indeed. So with that being the exception, I think there is a constant thread. Like you, I see this constant thread throughout every iteration of Star Trek that is very minimalist. And to me, at least, that's the future. we see that not only in the design aesthetics of the ships that they're in, but the people. You go into their quarters, they're minimalist. They don't have a lot of clutter. There are not a lot of knickknacks sitting around.
One or two prize knickknacks,
yes,
maybe.
Yes, like, absolutely.
You know, one or two really important sentimental objects for each.
Yes, and that crazy chair in Worf's quarters that takes up half the... But other than that, you know, they're very minimalist. And so I hope going forward with Star Trek 2017, I hope that the design team that they put together will continue that, because that to me, I think, says something about who we are becoming as a people. We are driven forward in a future where we value people and relationships over things. And I think that that is a strong theme throughout Star Trek.
Well, for my final thoughts, I'm not sure I have much beyond what I've already said, but I think there's a number of things. I think for me, the design aspect of Star Trek is that Star Trek, all the manufactured objects you see in Star Trek tell a story about what the vision of the future should be like. And then you can kind of run that retroactively. What does that mean for us today? It's interesting and fun for me to talk about the minutiae of what I see on screen in Star Trek, and I can kind of geek out on any of the design elements. I grew up, reading my Star Trek The Next Generation technical manual by flashlight under my covers, right? I was so enamored by this design aspect because it was beautiful and simple and elegant and told a story about what life could be that is very different from the life I saw around me. And I'm very, very intrigued by this technological aspect, because I think that it's so the technological culture that we live in now, with all of these devices surrounding us that we really take for granted, we don't think about very much. They grew out of the environment that Star Trek grew out of, you know, these deep connections between progress and idealism. And even the counterculture movement in the 60s, all of these things are intimately tied together. And you can find really interesting books to read about all this stuff. One interesting book that I would recommend if anyone is even remotely interested in this, I can't remember the author's name, but you can find it by the title. There's a book called From Counterculture to Cyberculture. Mm. It's a really fascinating sort of sociological analysis of how this internet age that we're living in, the sort of we're descendants of the internet age of the 1990s now. It's 20-something years ago, right? All stems out of the environment that you see in the 1960s and 70s. And that's fascinating if you've never thought about it before. But for me, the thing I think I'm most excited about is the empowerment aspect of technology and the design of the objects around us. Already there are tools that can empower people to change their own lives. And if you haven't thought about it in those terms, like, yeah, I can literally learn something new and I can get a new skill and I can get a good job, or I can invent something that could change the world. And again, you know, it's one thing to, you know, make your own life better. That's still kind of maybe selfishly focused, right? Yeah, I can improve my own life. But if you want to improve the world, think about the devices that have really changed the world in very, very grand terms. I'm thinking all the way back from the beginning of human history, the wheel, fire. Fast forward a few thousand years, the printing press, right? Now, all of a sudden, it allows knowledge to be disseminated to countless millions of people that would never have access to information or literacy before that, right? Fast forward again, you get things like the telegraph and the railroad, things that expand our ability to move people and goods across distances. And think of the economies that emerged out of these inventions. Flash forward into the 20th century, you get things like radio and television, information getting disseminated across, in ways that it never was able to be before. You know, you can communicate and see, you know, you could see the Vietnam War happen on TV in the 1960s. That was going on while Star Trek was going on, right? Flash forward a little more and you get things like the personal computer and the internet. And I love the opening credits to Enterprise. I literally just thought that the opening credits to Enterprise really kind of give this account of the technological history of mankind, from sailing ships all the way to the Enterprise. It's an interesting story to tell, that we're still on this journey forward. Even right now, we're on this journey forward. We'll look back at this conversation in 20 years and go, oh my God, how could we not see what the future was going to be like? Well, they invented some amazing device that changed
you
all
say it's
going
to take a long time to get from here to there.
That's exactly what I'm saying. But my time is finally here. Yeah.
as Mike and Zach break out in Enterprise karaoke.
Yeah. So what does that mean? I mean, you know, this trend will continue. There will be new devices that have this transformative power, and we don't know what they are. You know, 100 years ago, people could never have predicted television. They could never have predicted, the internet. You know, there were maybe some vague idea of how technology could be used to improve communication. Think of Morse code and the telegraph, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, sure. There was already this idea that we need to communicate better. And I guess what's interesting to me about that as kind of a final thought is human nature hasn't changed very much. We still need to communicate. We still need to travel. We still need to get goods from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. The basic human needs and conditions and desires haven't really changed that much at all. And that's what allows us, I think, to read thousands of years of human history and find the stories and the people very relatable.
Yes.
You know, the human element is very consistent across cultures. There's a lot that does change across cultures, a lot that doesn't translate, a lot about a worldview that doesn't necessarily translate, but these basic sort of needs and drives and desires, I think, is largely consistent. As any historian of Roman graffiti will attest to, the human condition hasn't changed very much. It makes me ask, what would 24th century graffiti be like? Have they weeded out graffiti in the 24th century?
We see some on Deep Space Nine.
Do you have like an Akutagram sketch pad to draw graffiti? You know, just touchscreen graffiti. Go home, Romulans. if you're a fan of Monty Python, you'll get the joke.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Nice.
So I'm interested in the progression, and I think you can wait for it to unfold, or you can really take the time to embrace the technology that is around you and the tools that other people invented for you and try to make the world a better place. And if you're not thinking about that a little bit, I feel like you're not grasping kind of the soul of Star Trek's view of technology, that we can solve these problems because we can use our minds and we can come together as people and we can use the technology, we can invent better tools, and we can make the world and the galaxy and the universe a better place. And if you're not trying to do that a little bit, you're just missing a big part of the Star Trek story, I think. So I think those are my final thoughts. You know, really embrace the idea that we can literally change the future if we put our minds to it and use the tools today.
Well said, well said. I know one thing is for certain. I will see my dreams come alive at last. I will touch the sky. And they're not gonna hold me down no
more. No, they're not gonna change my mind. Should we do the chorus? I feel like we should give a chorus. Because I've got faith of the heart.
Belt it out, Zachary.
Yeah, that's all I got in me. I used to be a good singer, but it's been a long time. So. My grandmother was a choral teacher. She is rolling over in her grave. I have no doubt. Sorry, Grandma.
Well, Zachary, it sure has been fun talking about the industrial design philosophy of Star Trek, and we threw quite a bit in there about technology as well. But this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And I'm saying this in a really good and loving way. Sometimes some things can't be unseen, but there is nothing cooler than Disco Bones. I mean, I know we're supposed to be in the 23rd century somewhere, but that was squarely 1970-something.
Oh, yeah, sure. It was perfect.
To the journey! I think the only thing that we need to propagate in this new Star Trek show, and I feel like what Voyager propagated as well, is work together, become a family, love each other like family, and you'll be able to overcome any kind of obstacle.
And that is exactly what Voyager did.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Every single one of these movies has been good. So the idea that the first time that he's going to make a bad movie, like the one where he's going to drop the ball, is a Star Trek movie written by Simon Pegg, that does not compute.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, hey, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. And Zachary, that makes me wonder, what does it say about our listeners if they are not Apple users? Just a thought.
Well, there's still Trek FM listeners.
There's still Trek FM, and we love. I'm not an Apple user. I have an iPad, but I'm Android on my phone. So, no hate mail, please. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm. You'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team. Hey, you could even join one of our patron roundtables and podcast on Trek FM. Many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us your thoughts on anything that we've discussed in this episode of MetaTrex, or discuss anything that we've talked about in previous episodes. You can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on our website. Go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our MetaTrek show page on the Trek FM website, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
You can find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @TrekFM.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM, and also find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook. That's B-A-B-E-L. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. And just a quick plug for the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is a great place to continue the discussion if you want to keep talking about Star Trek and philosophy with us here, about anything you heard on MetaTrex. If you want to talk about any other aspect of the Star Trek universe that happens to be near and dear to you, if you want to pick up a thread that you heard on any other Trek FM podcast, the Babel Conference is a listeners-only discussion group. So it's only for Trek FM listeners. It's a closed group. Just hit join and someone will let you right in. And it's a great place to connect with your fellow listeners and all of the hosts of the other podcasts on Trek FM as well.
We'd also like to invite our listeners, Zachary, to leave us a rating and review of MetaTrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. If you do leave us a rating or review, please reach out and contact us and let us know that you've done so, especially if you leave us a rating or review on one of the international iTunes stores, so we can be sure and look that up. We might even share your review on the podcast.
Yeah, if you haven't taken the time to leave us a rating and a review of MetaTrex, and if you like what we're trying to do in bringing together Star Trek and philosophy, please take a couple minutes out of your day to leave us a rating and a review. It's one of the quickest and simplest things you can do to help us out and help other people find the show.
Well, Zachary, when you're not sitting in Captain Janeway's conference room with your feet up on that overstated conference table looking at the Whole Earth catalog, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
That's quite a mental image there of myself with my feet kicked back on the Voyager conference table reading the Whole Earth catalog. That captures me pretty well.
I think
well.
So.
Good job, Mike. Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group on Facebook, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can always find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not making space graffiti with your Okudagram flat screen, where can people find you these days?
Well, certainly they can find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, and certainly around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. Well, Zachary, we need to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTrex team from around the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau. Also, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Castello, our editor and producer. We'd also like to acknowledge our associate producer, Patrick Devlin. Patrick, thank you for your support of Trek FM and MetaTrex. You can connect with Patrick via Twitter. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5. Well, thanks everyone for taking the time to listen to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.